Hello, listeners. It's March, and it's that time again where we delve into our podcast, Healthy Intersections by Medical Care. This month's Healthy Intersections recaps our blog post from the Medical Care blog. First, we have Dr. Flegg with the new pandemic philosophy of social fitnessing and how incorporating a daily recommended active lifestyle can potentially reduce morbidity and mortality due to sickness and factors from COVID. Now, it remains to be seen whether this is across all age groups, comorbidities, and other factors, but what a nice way to get out and move rather than social distance and chill. Next, we have Dr. Gregory Stevens, co-editor of the Medical Care blog and on the editorial board of the journal, with his contribution. Did you know that Medicare Advantage will potentially supersede traditional Medicare this year? CMS is collecting overpayments to Medicare Advantage, and private insurers have the most to gain from all this. Head to the blog to drop your thoughts and read more on this very hot topic. And last but not least, we have a thoughtful post regarding insulin prices and whether Eli Lilly's moves to slash prices is really a benefit in disguise for the pharmaceutical company. Who are all the players that set the stage for rising drug costs? As always, we encourage you to head to the blog and drop your thoughts because we love to hear from you. Now, I want to recap a few articles from the Medical Care Journal from the month of April. We have an editorial on role reversal, the potential impact of child health on the medical and social health of parents by Aronson, Garg, and Trivedi. What a novel take on a very common issue. We also have a couple of original articles to highlight, including chronic illness in children and foregone care among household adults in the United States, a national study that was done. There's also a novel take about a study that was conducted in Denmark on using explainable artificial intelligence to predict potentially preventable hospitalization. It's a population-based cohort study. What a novel way to introduce the use of AI in healthcare. And with that, I wish all our listeners a very happy spring season ahead and hand it over to Dr. Jess Williams from the Medical Care section.
Today, I'm talking with Daniel Harris, who is the lead author of a paper published in the March 2023 issue of Medical Care about the potential unintended consequences of antipsychotic medication reduction in nursing homes. Dr. Harris completed this study while a PhD student at the Dalai Lama School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Dan currently works as a research scientist at the Brown University School of Public Health. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
And thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to talk about this study.
So can you start by giving our listeners just a little background on antipsychotic use in nursing homes and why we've tried to reduce it?
Absolutely. So there's a long history of overuse and misuse of antipsychotics in the long-term care setting that goes back to the 1980s. And these medications have largely been used to treat dementia's behavioral and psychological symptoms, so things like agitation and psychoses. However, the clinical efficacy of antipsychotics is pretty modest for those dementia symptoms, and they have pretty notable health risks. So things like increasing the risk of falls and as well as excess sedation. So due to the risks and limited effectiveness at treating these symptoms, there have been a number of efforts to try to reduce their use in nursing homes, and largely have attempted to replace antipsychotics with non-pharmacological strategies for those dementia symptoms.
Thank you. And clearly, there are always ways around restrictions and safeguards that could put in place. And which workarounds are you most worried about?
So, you know, this is a good question. And I would say that foremost, I'm actually worried that nursing homes have the resources required to sustainably reduce antipsychotic medications and to put in place those non-pharmacological strategies. So I think that's the first thing that I'm thinking about. Because in a context where nursing homes are under-resourced, there may be an increase in pressure to continue to use antipsychotic medications. And perhaps use various diagnosis codes, for example, things like delusions here in Canada or schizophrenia in the US, to perhaps mask antipsychotic use from those publicly reported indicators. Or it may lend to an increase in the use of other psychotropic medications in the place of antipsychotics, so things like trazodone or valproate, for example. So I'm actually worried about all of these things. And I think I'm worried about within the within the current public reporting infrastructure, both in Canada, in the US, and in the US, how well increases in those substitution drugs could be recorded, and how well increases in those diagnoses are being recorded.
Those are great points. So one thing I noticed sort of getting back to the paper was that you had excluded residents who didn't have any recent medication claims. And sort of how do you think this affected your sample and the overall generalizability of your results? I mean, it sort of depends, I guess, on, you know, how many folks in the data set actually didn't have medication claims. Mm-hmm. You know, in the US, that number in a nursing home setting would be very low. Mm-hmm. But what's it like in Ontario?
Exactly. So in Ontario, that number is very low. I believe the number, I have to look at the paper exactly, but I believe it was less than 200 people in the nursing home did not have a record for a medication in the prior year. So, you know, I do not think that this affected the generalizability of the sample, because folks who live in this setting are receiving medications, and folks who are not receiving a medication probably is not at all similar to those who live in long-term care.
That's a great point. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So what were your main findings about the use of antipsychotics and antidepressants over time?
So what we had done in this study is we had measured three outcomes at the facility level. So we measured every facility's use of potentially inappropriate antipsychotics, use of antidepressants, and then the prevalence of residents who had a diagnosis that's used to define appropriate antipsychotic use. So a diagnosis of delusions or schizophrenia, for example. So we measured this at 39 time points to see how facilities changed over time on each of these three outcomes. And the goal was to assess whether changes in those outcomes were correlated with each other. And the hypothesis was, if there's this, you know, potential shift in the way that diagnoses are recorded as a result of efforts to reduce antipsychotics, that the trend in antipsychotics would be correlated with the trend in the change in those diagnoses. And that's what we had found. So facilities, on average, that had greater reductions in potentially inappropriate antipsychotics tended to have greater increases in those diagnoses that are used to define appropriate antipsychotics. So that was the strongest correlation. We also observed a small signal for trazodone. So facilities that had larger reductions in potentially inappropriate antipsychotics over time tended to have slightly greater increases in the use of trazodone over time. So we believe that this is, you know, facility level evidence of that these various constructs are interrelated with each other. And it's potential evidence that efforts to reduce antipsychotics may have resulted in a change in the way that diagnoses are recorded, possibly masking antipsychotic use, or an increase in the use of trazodone, possibly as a substitute for antipsychotics.
Interesting. And I also noticed you had a lot of great sensitivity analyses. So were there any sensitivity analyses that you found sort of particularly convincing or supportive of kind of your main findings you described?
Yes. So we did do a few analyses. There are two that come to mind. The first was that we wanted to assess a period following antipsychotic reduction efforts in Ontario. So the full study period included data from 2010 to 2019. But in Ontario, antipsychotic reduction efforts really began to ramp up in 2014 and 2015. So we assessed the degree of correlation in those time trends in that latter half of the period. And we actually saw a strengthening of the patterns. So that kind of gave us some confidence that these antipsychotic reduction efforts have lent to increases in the use of diagnosis codes, possibly as a strategy to mask antipsychotic use. The other analysis that we had done was we had stratified facilities according to their rates of change for all of those, for those three outcomes, antipsychotics, antidepressants, and those diagnoses, to compare their baseline characteristics. And we didn't really observe very many differences across them, which leads us to believe that maybe these differences in coding and these differences in antipsychotic and other medication use is really related to a culture or kind of a facility culture pattern that's kind of driving these patterns and trends over time.
My next question for you, Dan, is really about future directions. So what do you think are sort of the most productive avenues for future research in this area?
You know, I think this is a great area and there's certainly a lot of work to do. I would say that we need to have a focus on the structural elements of this. So ensuring that nursing homes have the sufficient resources in place to institute those best practices for dementia care and to understand that these differences in diagnosis coding and differences in use of medications may simply reflect a more complex nursing home population. And it'll be important for us to determine and understand exactly how and what is truly driving these changes in the nursing home setting.
The last question I really have for you is about the applicability of the results to other areas. So obviously, you know, your paper focuses on nursing homes in Ontario, but do you think any of your results might be sort of more broadly applicable either to sort of other provinces or to the United States?
This is a great question too. And I do think that they are. I think that when we look at this at a high level, we can see and recognize that, you know, policies to change a practice can often have unintended consequences, where, you know, you try to reduce antipsychotics and then this other practice changes as a result. In Ontario, we see this has resulted in a change in the diagnosis of the specific diagnosis codes of delusions. In the US, the specific diagnosis code might be different, but there still may be an important shift in the way that diagnosis codes are used. So across jurisdictions, the specific manifestations may be different. But at a high level, just being considerate of how policies can change practices in unintended ways and to try to anticipate those unintended ways, I think is important. And that certainly applies not only across Canada, but also in the US and in other countries as well.
Great. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you think would be important for our listeners to know about this issue?
You know, I think that, when it comes down to the nursing home setting, I think what's really, really key is understanding the interplay between the accessible of resources that nursing homes have to implement the best practices for dementia care. And as a health system, I think that we should think of ways to optimize the resources that are available to homes to really put the best practices into place.
Appreciate talking with you today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast today. We hope that you subscribe on whatever platform you get your podcast and head over to our website, themedicalcareblog.com, and sign up for future posts.